The following is the final part in our four-part series here on Tales from the South.
This is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
How's everybody doing tonight? Woo! Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, a good crowd out there. So, we've got, and I hope you all enjoyed the salty dogs before we got up here. How about the salty dogs? Yeah! Well, if you want to listen to more of that salty, salty music, check out thesaltydogs.net. Okay, you can find more of their music there, thesaltydogs.net. So, welcome to a very special Tales from the South. This is their out loud storytelling show where LGBT Southerners and allies bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at South on Main in Little Rock, Arkansas. The Tales from the South is presented by the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops, and tonight's show is sponsored by HRC, the Human Rights Campaign, and Yellow Rocket Concepts. Yes, come on. Thank you to our sponsors, and I will be your guest MC, Tracy Berry. So for those of you out there listening and all those other places, Paula is still with us. I did not kidnap her and shoo her away. She's in the building. On my left here, playing for us tonight, is blue guitarist Mark Simpsons. Playing the blues. Thank you, Mark. And on our backdrop here, our set, we have the work of V.L. Cox. V.L. Cox is a passionate advocate for justice. She feels that despite our differences such as cultural, religious, economic, race, or gender, we can choose a peaceful path of tolerance and justice instead of fear, repression, and hatred, using historical elements of the past in projects based on culture and social change. The images in VL's projects visually engage the observer and become a focal point for discussion. So if you want to check out more works from VL, go to www.greatfineart.com. All right, so enough of that business. Are you ready to hear some stories? Yeah, let's give it up. So, all the stories tonight are true and told by Southerners who have lived them. So to go ahead and kick us off, we have Chad Jones.
I was raised in a small town, and I grew up Southern Baptist, fundamentalist Christian, and from a very early age, my faith has been a cornerstone of my life. It's been a part of who I am and the way I view the world, and it's been the most important part of who I am. When I was in high school, I went to a small Christian school. If I would have finished school there, my graduating class would have been five people instead of four. That was where I met my friend Patrick. And Patrick and I bonded really early on because we shared a love for the greatest band that has ever walked the face of the earth, Queen. And it started early on because I remember in our algebra class, Patrick had a Queen folder, and I looked over there and I saw it, and I was like, that's awesome, man, I love Queen. And our teacher came over to us and said, that's immoral secular music, you need to put that away. And we had a good laugh, and we were like, okay, all right, whatever. We laughed about it and went on about our day. Our lunchroom had a little piano in it, and our lunchroom, this is a small school, so our lunchroom was a lunchroom slash activity room slash gymnasium slash all-purpose room. And after lunch, we would go over there, and we had a little free time, and we would go over to the piano, and Patrick would play Queen songs, and we'd sit there and sing to each other. And every now and then, one of the teachers or the attendants would catch on to what we were doing and come over and say, you guys got to stop playing that music. That's immoral, secular music. You got to stop it. And we'd say, okay, all right, whatever. teacher would walk off, and we'd go back to singing Bohemian Rhapsody because we didn't really care. I found out later on from Patrick that Freddie Mercury was gay. I had no idea. And he said to me, well, does that change how you feel about Freddie Mercury because he's gay? I said, no, he's awesome. And, you know, it took me by surprise because Freddie Mercury is a rock star and a sex symbol, and I didn't really understand it much. But he said, does that change how you feel about Freddie Mercury being gay? And I said, no. And Patrick wasn't out. Everybody knew he was gay. But Patrick said to me, does that change how you feel about me? Because I'm gay. Patrick was my first gay friend. And I said, no, that doesn't change a thing. You're my friend. I don't care. And Patrick was always quick with a joke, and he turned to me and said, well, that's cool, because I don't care that you're straight. So, well, in 2001, I left that school. I went back to public school to finish my senior year. And Patrick and I stayed in touch. He went on, and eventually Patrick came out. And he always told me how he had such a hard time with it. He felt lost. He felt alone. He felt isolated. He didn't really know who to turn to. But he always confided in me, and I was always there for him. He had a hard time with it. He turned to drinking. He turned to drugs. His health went downhill. In November of 2003, I got the call that Patrick had died. And I remember going to his funeral, and you would think, of all things, that the funeral would be the hardest part, but it wasn't. I kept in touch with people from my school, people who said that they were Christians. These were the very people who bullied Patrick when he was in school, who told him that there's no such thing as a gay Christian. God doesn't love you. You need to pray the gay away. There's something wrong with you. Those very people called me after Patrick's funeral and said, we're going to pray for Patrick because there's no such thing as a gay Christian and we need to keep him out of hell. And that was a major turning point in my life. I questioned everything. I almost lost my faith. I didn't know where to turn or what to do. Everything just didn't make sense to me anymore because all these people who said that they were Christian, who served the same God that I served, told my friend Patrick, who loved life, who loved God as much as I did, that there was no such thing as a gay Christian and that he didn't have a place at God's table. And I found that to be complete and total bullshit. So a friend of mine said to me, he said, you know what, you gotta sit, you gotta spend some time and reflect. Read your Bible, spend some time in the text, and really just reflect on it. And I did. And that was when organized religion went from being organized religion to becoming personal faith for me. And it enriched my faith. And it was a major turning point in my life. And, you know, a lot of people talk about politicians and how they didn't support gay marriage before and how they do now. They didn't support LGBT rights and they do now. And they say that they flip-flopped their opinions. And that's not true. People don't change. People evolve. I evolved. My relationship with Patrick was a turning point in my life, and it made me who I am today, and it made me a part of this movement that I'm so proud to be a part of as a straight ally. Yeah. I left the restaurant business and went into a field of social work so that I could help people like Patrick who felt lost and alone, like they didn't have a place to turn. I'm raising my children to love and accept all people regardless of who they are, who they love, sexual orientation, gender identity, none of that matters because they're all people. And my children are not going to bully people like the same Christian friends I had who bullied Patrick. I serve a God of love. His love is inclusive. It's not exclusive. He doesn't care who you are. He doesn't care what you've done. He doesn't care who you love. You don't have to choose between who you are and your faith. The two go hand in hand. You don't have to feel alone. You don't have to feel isolated. I cannot wait until the day that I get up to heaven and I walk through the pearly gates and I see my friend Patrick. We spin a Queen record together. And I see him just as loved and accepted as a gay Christian as I am as a straight one. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Chad. Chad, again, you've already said this, but I want to make it clear. He is a straight ally. Thank goodness for our straight allies. Yeah, go ahead. We need them, and we appreciate them. He also has served on the board of the Arkansans for Equality, and he is an ordained minister who is more than happy to marry LGBT couples. So remember that, Chad Jones, when you want to get married. Thank you, Chad.
Tales from the South will return after this brief musical intermission.
Put on your boots and stay a while, and cast all your cares away. With country music flows like wine, we're gonna have one heck of a time at the old folks home. At the old folks' home, he'll always wear a smile. At the old folks' home, those girls, they'll drive. They're two-stepping fools. Now don't you know, at the old folks home. Play along. Ashamed, or don't be afraid to stop on by and have a good time. Serve a coffee black, you know what a thrill when I light up the faces with the meals on wheels at the old folks home. He'll always wear a smile, that is true. At the old folks' home, those girls, they'll drive you wild. Turn your partner around and don't say At the old folks' home, he'll always wear a smile. At the old folks' home, those girls, they'll drive. Well, in 32, be 49, or 22, I'm a-feeling fine at the old folks' home.
All right, next up on the Tales from the South, we have Ruth Coker Burks.
I bought my dress for the first Clinton inaugural ball from a drag queen, Miss Misty McCall. Everyone loved Misty, and she could do Cher better than Cher could do Cher. She had a double-wide trailer that she had taken down a wall in one of the three bedrooms and turned it into a fabulous drag closet. I remember my mother and I being treated with the greatest of hospitality by Misty and some of her friends. I'm not sure that they weren't as amused by us as we were just fascinated with her closet. Rick was Misty's male alter ego, and she was his female alter ego, and I'm really not sure where that line really was and how much they intertwined, and how utterly proud that one of her gowns would be worn at a presidential inaugural. Who in the whole wide world would have ever imagined? And just the fact that I would send out the call and she would answer back that I was welcome to come over and maybe find one of hers. It was a dream come true for both of us. I was only in my early 30s and broke, but in possession of the one golden ticket that everyone coveted. I walked into the closet wide-eyed and very timid. You have no idea how intimidating it is to walk into a glamorous closet full of the most beautiful clothes that I had ever seen. Two whole bedrooms of glorious gowns and dresses and hats and wigs, and Misty told me with great pride that they would go to the Miss Texas pageant and make note of the gowns and evening wear that they liked, and the pageant was over, they would buy the clothes from the girls who didn't make it to become Miss Texas. The girls they brought from were the rich daddies and only wanted the very best for their little girls and didn't mind paying for the very best. I remember my eyes growing even wider and remembering thinking to myself as time stood still, how lucky could I be not only to have gotten the invitation to the most glamorous and historical event in the United States of America, the presidential inaugural ball. I remember how much I used to dream of that glamorous event and how much fun it would be to get an invitation. And here I was actually going to the same event that I had so long ago dreamt of going to. And as I looked at that in my dog-eared encyclopedia of long ago, it was now me whom fate had turned to, and fate had handed me that golden ticket, much, much like Cinderella. And now I wouldn't be wearing a Walmart special. Now I'd be going in a beautiful gown from my friend, a drag queen. Starting at the top of the closet, there were wigs and hats and headpieces, all meticulously setting on a shelf, beautifully coiffed, groomed, and stored. Then there were the gowns and the dresses and the evening wear. And then on the floor in piles were the very expensive beaded gowns. And I was shocked, and I asked her, why all those expensive gowns laying in piles on the floor? And I'll always remember her words of wisdom. Girl, you never hang a beaded gown. The weight of the gown will tear at the seams and it'll be ruined. I don't know how many gowns I tried on that night. Silk, taffeta ball gowns. None of them were up to Misty standards. So she pulled out a beaded gown. And I told her, oh, no, I don't have the figure to pull that off. And she arched one of her eyebrows and she told me to try it on anyway. She knew the green one just wasn't... just didn't work. A pale pink, absolutely gorgeous beaded. Voila, that was it. It was her favorite gown. I kind of argued with her that I just wasn't sure, but I forgot one very important piece of advice I learned early on in my career. Never argue with a drag queen. This dress was so beautiful, and I had never felt that I was pretty enough to pull it off, and Misty and her friends told me, work it, girl, work it, and own it. So that's exactly what I did. I paid her $200 and mentioned that I also had a cocktail party to go to and didn't have anything to wear to that either, and she thought for a minute, and she brought out a beautiful black velvet and gold brocade jacket and velvet skirt, and it was perfect. So she lent it to me since I'd already paid for the dress, and I was off to the ball. When I got to Washington, D.C., I met a soon-to-be friend, Ronnie Claire Edwards, at an intimate brunch at the home of a friend. She didn't have an invitation to the Arkansas party, which I was going to next, and I knew that she was famous, but I had no earthly idea who she was, but everyone else sure did. At the Arkansas party is where I wore that cocktail dress, and Ronnie Claire was dressed as, well, you know, Ronnie Claire, like a gypsy. We were a pair. People would stand in line to talk to a woman who was my guest, and I still had absolutely no idea who she was. People were asking for her pictures and all, and so I decided, you know, work it, go with it. And I pretended that I was famous and had my picture taken also. And it was so much fun. No one ever realized that I wasn't famous at all. When I got home, I had to watch at least 100 episodes of The Waltons to figure out that she was Cora Beth Walton. Everybody else knew. The next evening, I was the belle of the ball. I felt like $1 million, and I looked like it too. I had my beautiful beaded gown and green hooded cape, and I arrived, and I had the official photo taken so that I had proof that it really was me. I was really there. I just couldn't wrap my head around it. But duty calls, and the show must go on, and I knew that Misty was watching the TV to see if by any chance at all she could see her dress in Washington, D.C. Right as I walked into the ballroom, CNN had set up a booth. Everyone else had their eyes set there and were fighting to talk to people. A reporter grabbed my elbow and asked, "Who are you wearing?" I thought for sure she was talking to someone else, and she asked again. And it was really me that she was talking to. I couldn't believe it, and I told her, "I don't know." She then asked, "Where did you get your dress?" And all around, ladies were answering the same question that I had just been asked, and their answers were, "Versace. I got it in Paris, darling, last fall. I knew he'd win." I had to stop and think about my answer. Here I was, right in the middle of the richest people in the world. Then my inner drag queen kicked in, and I replied that it was from the Misty McCall collection. And that I had gotten it from a drag queen. Everything ground to a screeching halt. I saw people putting fingers in their ears and listening to someone talking to them. Then the reporter told me that she didn't think they could say drag queen on television, but could I please turn around and model the dress for the cameras? After that, a woman introduced herself to me and said that she was from W Magazine and asked who I was wearing. And again, I told her I didn't know that I'd purchased it from a drag queen. I knew I was onto something there, and Misty was saying, "Go, girl, go!" So then asked if she could look at my tag. Well, I let her unzip and dig around in the back of my dress because it seemed important to her, and, you know. I had no pride. So there we were in the middle of the ballroom trying to find the tag. She gasped, and she told me who it was. I was still clueless. You know, I didn't know. It must have really been something special from the look on her face. To this day, I still have no absolutely idea who it was. She was taking copious notes, and then she was trying to figure out what she was going to say on W Magazine. I assumed it was not the drag queen kind of thing. We bonded at that moment, and she was glued to my elbow from that moment on. Misty McCall had made it, a drag queen from Arkansas, made it to the biggest ball in the world, and now she was famous and a star again. Everything that I had learned from the beautiful and lovely drag queens from Arkansas, they gave me the greatest gift of all time 30 years ago. I got back to Arkansas and reported back to Misty of all the details in the dress was going to be in W Magazine, and it didn't mean anything to me, but it meant everything to her and the ladies of drag in Arkansas. I gave her a set of pictures and told her that I loved her, and we saw each other from time to time in the club when the ladies would put on drag shows to raise money for AIDS patients. They were the greatest. Many of them were infected themselves, and I had begun to bury a few in my family cemetery. Just a few years after that, I got the call that Rick, or Misty, was in the hospital in Little Rock and not doing well. I rushed to his side, and I told him that I loved him, and we called his mother, begging her to come and see him one last time. His mother never came. So I took Misty home, and I put her in a cookie jar, and I buried her in my cemetery. But Miss Misty McCall will never be forgotten. She will always hold a place in my heart for her style, her fierceness, and her compassion. Thank you again, Misty. I love you.
How about that? Yeah.
Thank you, Ruth. Thank you for so much. So, those of you who don't know Ruth, she's known as the Cemetery Angel. She is now a grandmother living this is kind of a bio from way back, living a quiet life in Rogers, Arkansas. She took it as a calling to care for people with AIDS at the dawn of the epidemic in the 1980s in Arkansas, the majority of whom were gay men abandoned by their families. Now, I don't know if you know this, but since that, she's now been on NPR and BBC, and now she's trending on Reddit. So I don't know if your life's going to be so quiet up in anymore, but thank you for everything that you've done, Ruth. That's awesome. She was also she's the former executive director of HPWA, which is helping people with AIDS. So she's done some pretty amazing things. Yes, you are an ally, and we've had so many allies up on the stage tonight. And I just got to say that, you know, it's really important that we as LGBT people in the community share our stories. You know, we have a voice. We need to use it. But, golly, I mean, all the allies that have come to stand by our side over the last year and a half and maybe even more, as we've had Ruth here since the 80s, you know, they are just as important too. So thank you to all of our allies. And I know that we have a lot of you guys here in the audience tonight. So thank you for your voice and thank you for sharing it. Yeah. So how about all of the 10 storytellers that we had tonight? Yeah. Yeah, they did a great job. Thank you guys so much. So real quick, thank you to all of our writers, all of our storytellers. Thank you to our live audience, all of you guys. Thank you to South on Main for hosting us tonight. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops, and tonight's show is sponsored again by the Human Rights Campaign, HRC, and Yellow Rocket Concepts. Additional support provided by UALR's School of Mass Communications, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, Little Rock Soiree Magazine, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Arkansas Arts Council, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us, Tales from the South, on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher, Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are open for submissions from all Southerners, and more can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Thank you guys so much for being here tonight. Thank you for your support. It means so much to our community. Please keep doing what you're doing. Have a good night.
Out Loud Storytelling was conceived, produced, and directed by Hillary Trudell. Ms. Trudell is a longtime ally who believes in the power of story to create positive social change. She currently resides in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Writer accommodations for Tales from the South provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast in Little Rock. More at robinwoodbnb.com. And the Baker House Bed and Breakfast in North Little Rock. More at bakerhousenlr.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by the UALR School of Mass Communication. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can all be found on our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for keeping the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.
That must be jelly, 'cause jam don't shake like that. And must be jelly, cause Jim don't shake like that. And she's looking mighty fine, she's dancing in a cowboy hat. Well, she piles her hair up high and she shimmies down low. And she piles her hair up high and she shimmies down low. And she's looking mighty fine and she's ready to rip and go. Staring back at me. Walmart towel, Bart Angel.